Chapter 8. The container ship Ocean Adventure could hold nearly 2,000 cargo containers, but even at 7,000 tons and a length of 500 feet, it was a pygmy compared with newer box ships that were as long as 3 football fields laid end to end. The finer points of spatial relativism were lost on Karina McCarty as she strode along the ship's long deck, huddled against the bone-chilling rawness of the North Atlantic. Since boarding at Salerno, Karina had arisen early each morning and descended from her cabin on the third level of the bridge house to go on a brisk walk before breakfast. Her compulsion was fueled by an unnecessary obsession with keeping her lithe figure in shape and to soothe her impatience at reaching her destination. The number of laps varied according to the weather, which ranged from raw dampness to the bitingly cold air off the coast of Newfoundland. The Ocean Adventure inspired little of the romance immortalized by Joseph Conrad's tales of the doughty tramp steamers that plied the world's oceans in a bygone age. The ship was a sea-going platform that carried steel container units 20 feet long by about 8 feet tall. They were stacked 6 high and covered most of the deck, except for 4 and aft, and narrow aisles on either side. Hundreds more containers were stored below decks. As Karina made her way along the starboard rail, she recalled the chain of events that had brought her to a ship plowing its way across the Atlantic. The murder of Ali Baba's some years before in Baghdad had shocked but not surprised her. Violence always lurked behind the scenes in the high-stakes trade in illegal antiquities. It was a shadowy world where enormous sums of money flowed and gentlemen were rarely found. Ali had probably double-crossed the wrong person. She had mourned his death nonetheless. Without Ali, it was doubtful she would ever recover the lost cache of antiques. Ali had been the middleman who moved stolen goods to market. He had committed nothing to paper. The names of his buyers and sellers had been in his head. With the sleazy dealer out of the picture, the antiquities she had sought had been scattered to the four winds. Karina had had plenty to keep her busy once she left Iraq and returned to her UNESCO office in Paris. Months after leaving Baghdad, she'd been on the trail of a rare Etruscan statue when Auguste Benoit visited her office and presented his card. Benoit was a prim, perfidious man who reminded Karina of Agatha Christie's fictitious detective Hercule Poirot. Benoit was a partner in a prestigious Paris law firm, and he got right to the point.
"My firm has been retained to represent the Balthazar Foundation," he said. "Mr. Balthazar is a wealthy businessman and philanthropist. He was quite saddened when he heard about the looting of the Baghdad Museum. Mr. Balthazar had read an article describing your efforts to find a cache of stolen antiquities, and he is hopeful that with funding from his foundation, you could devote your talents to restoring these objects to the Iraqi collection."
"That's very kind of Mr. Balthazar," Karina had replied. "However, I believe I can be more valuable working with a worldwide organization like UNESCO."
"Forgive me for not being clear about Mr. Balthazar's proposition. You would not be required to leave UNESCO."
Karina glanced at the folders piled up on her desk.
"As you can see, I am buried in UNESCO work." "Understandable."
Benoit produced a single sheet of paper from his briefcase.
"This is the agreement that is being proposed. The foundation would donate an ongoing grant in a bank of your choice. You could draw on the bank account at any time for any purpose, with one stipulation. The money must be spent to recover the Iraqi artifacts. There is no current limits on the funds available."
Suddenly interested, Karina considered the offer.
"Mr. Balthazar is most generous."
Benoit beamed.
"Well, Mademoiselle McCarty?"
Karina was in a quandary. She was balancing several UNESCO assignments, but she couldn't let a chance like this pass. She scanned the agreement.
Let me study this proposal, and I'll call you tomorrow with my answer. The next day, she called Benoit and told him her answer was yes. In her UNESCO job, Karina had worked with governments, international police, museum people, and archaeology experts, but the possibilities of unlimited funding opened up whole new worlds. With wads of cash in her hand, she would be able to buy access to the unsavory characters who populated the antiquities trade. And so it was. Soon she developed an effective network of police and underworld informants who often gave her leads on antiquities missing from countries other than Iraq. One of her more reliable sources was a crooked Egyptian army officer she knew only as the Colonel. Less than a week before, he had called her out of the blue with the news that the cache of Iraqi objects she had been looking for was being put up for sale by a petty thief named Hassan. She told the officer that she would see him within 48 hours, wired him a deposit, and told him to make the buy sight unseen. The agreement with the Balthazar Foundation required that she keep it informed of immediate developments. She called Benoit with the news about Hassan, and Benoit said he would pass the news along. Before flying to Cairo, she called Professor Nasir in Baghdad and told him that she was close to recovering the cash. Nasir was delighted, but conditions were still unsettled in Iraq, and he was worried about the safety of the collection. He was trying to find funds to set up an efficient record-keeping system for the museum's existing collection. Nasir enthusiastically embraced Karina's suggestion that the artifacts be used to leverage donations. He would sign a waiver allowing her to keep the artifacts temporarily in her possession and would contact the Iraqi embassy in Washington to alert the diplomatic staff to the possibility of a tour. Events moved quickly when she got to Egypt. Over lunch at the Nile Sheraton Hotel, the colonel said he had already acquired the collection. He gallantly bought her lunch after she had paid him his full fee. That night, in a warehouse on the docks of Port Said, she had waited with growing excitement for the truck that pulled in shortly after midnight. The artifacts in the truck were covered with dirt, but they were in more or less decent condition. She did a quick inventory by flashlight, writing down a description and number for each item. After spreading more of Balthazar's wealth around the waterfront and the customs office, she had the load put on a freighter that was leaving for Italy. Flying ahead of the freighter to Salerno, she arranged for the transshipment of the cargo to the United States on the Ocean Adventure, and during the nervous wait, she nailed down the tour plans with Nasir and the embassy. When the freighter finally arrived, she called Benoit and told him she had taken possession of the antiquities in preparation for a tour. He sounded strangely disappointed, but called back later, saying he had consulted with Balthazar, who congratulated her on the find. Karina decided not to let the artifacts out of her sight again and had booked a cabin on the container ship. She stopped during her walk now and peered down an alley between stacks to make sure that the blue-painted container was still there. She continued on to the bow, where a blast of icy air hit her as she stepped out onto the open deck. The captain had told her over dinner the night before that the ship's cruising speed was 18 knots. He would reduce that as they neared Newfoundland and entered the area known as Iceberg Alley. The warning made her more curious than fearful. She paused at the bow to look for icebergs. Only trunk-sized chunks floated in the gray sea. Several layers of clothing were still not enough to keep the icy fingers of wind from tickling her ribs. Hot coffee and scrambled eggs would be waiting in the mess hall. She turned her back to the open sea and headed along the ship's port side. Karina was about two-thirds of the way to the bridge when she heard a beating sound above the swash of the hull through the sea. She looked up and saw a pair of helicopters flying close together a couple of hundred feet above water level. They were rapidly approaching the ship. No markings of any kind were visible on the black fuselages. Karina was surprised at their sudden appearance.
The ship was 100 miles from land. She remembered the captain's mention of oil and gas rigs in the area. The helicopters must belong to a drilling platform. The helicopters buzzed the ship barely above mast level, banked around in a tight formation, and circled the moving vessel like birds of prey in an ever-tightening spiral before disappearing out of the line of sight. The sound of spinning rotors faded. The helicopters evidently had landed on top of the container stacks. Karina was sure she'd learn the identity of the visitors when she got to the mess hall and resumed her walk, only to suddenly stop in her tracks. Ahead of her, a figure dropped down from a container stack at the end of a rope and landed on the deck. 3 more figures rappelled down the rope and stood in her way. Masks hid their faces except for the eyes. All were dressed in tight-fitting black uniforms. All were armed with short-barreled automatic weapons. Karina turned and ran, but 4 more armed figures had descended from the stacks behind her, and they closed in on her like a pair of pliers. One of the strangers grabbed her by the arm and spun her around, and her wrists were roughly tied behind her back with duct tape. She was shoved in the direction of the bridge house. When she didn't move fast enough, a muzzle poked her painfully between the shoulder blades. More figures were coming in their direction. Karina recognized 2 Filipino crewmen. She saw their smiling faces, and the situation became crystal clear. The Filipinos were working with the hijackers. The raiding party split up into 2 groups. 1 crewman set out toward the bridge house with 4 hijackers. The other man led the way toward the bow. The whole operation had been conducted in silence. These men knew what they were doing and what they wanted, Karina thought. But she was dumbfounded when the crewman directed her to the container box holding her artifacts and rapped his gloved knuckles on the metal surface. The container door was blocked by other boxes. A hijacker opened a metal suitcase and removed a torch and oxygen tank. He assembled the torch, ignited the flame, and adjusted it to a fine point. He donned a pair of goggles to protect his eyes from the shower of sparks and methodically began to cut a hole in the side of the container. An involuntary cry of protest escaped Karina's lips. Her outburst brought an instant response. One of her captors grabbed her arms and kicked her in the ankle at the same time. Karina, having lost her footing and unable to use her arms to break her fall, hit the deck. Her forehead smashed against a hard surface, and she blacked out. When she regained consciousness, she was lying on her back in semi-darkness. Her head throbbed with pain. She rolled over on her side and saw that she was wedged between 2 wooden cartons inside the container. Light streamed into the space from a rectangular hole framed by ragged edges from the cutting torch. She tried to stand, but it was difficult to get her feet under her with her hands bound behind her back, and the effort made her dizzy. As she lay on the cold steel floor with her chest heaving from exertion, she saw a shadow against the crates. A man peered in at her through the hole. His face was slightly plump around the cheeks, but the round eyes that stared out of the cherubic face had a demonic intensity. Karina's blood ran cold. It was one of the most frightening faces she had ever seen. Her expression must have mirrored her thoughts, because the man smiled. Karina was almost grateful when she passed out again.